is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I go to Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute. He is in the Middle East observing events in the Black Sea Basin and across the Middle East and all the way to Mother England. Let us begin with the incidents of these last hours that remain unresolved. Sharp words and perhaps gunfire exchanged. Reuters, London, Moscow. Russia accused Britain on Thursday in these last hours of spreading lies over a warship confrontation in the Black Sea and warned London that it would respond resolutely to any further provocative actions by the British Navy off the coast of Russia annexed Crimea. Russia summoned the British ambassador in Moscow for a formal diplomatic scolding after the warship breached what the Kremlin says are its territorial waters, but which Britain and most of the world say belong to Ukraine. That incident conjoined with this unusual presentation of the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, enjoying an overwhelming majority of the Conservatives in Parliament for some years yet. Mr. Johnson is appearing on the front page of the Telegraph, the London Telegraph, a newspaper long associated with the Conservative Party, in an armored personnel carrier with what looks to be an extremely dangerous 50-caliber machine gun right above his head. He's in the driver's seat. We're told that the Prime Minister is visiting Aldershot Garrison to mark Armed Forces Week. Perhaps coincidental, but then in the same telegraph, we have an item from the Middle East. Paratroopers drop into the desert at dawn as UK sends warning to Russia. The subhead, in an exclusive dispatch, Daniel Sheridan reports from alongside Army's latest operation in Jordan as UK bolsters its Middle East presence. Anatole, that's enough to say that what we've got here are distant war drums, something you and I grew used to in our youth, because this is Cold War behavior. You have posted at Quincy Institute that these provocations in part stem from using warships and warriors as diplomatic gestures. How so, Anatole? Good day to you.
Hello, John. It's nice to be with you again. Well, of course, Britain, like the rest of the West and most of the world, as you said, does not recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. It has, you know, made, as it should have, repeated official and diplomatic statements to that effect. The problem, of course, of making gestures like this on the ground, or in this case at sea, is that it more or less compels the other side to make some kind of response. You know, it's just like America sailing its warships past these Chinese-claimed islands in the South China Sea. Of course, it rubs home the point, but it also creates a real risk of some form of collision. In my piece, I referenced the incident in 2001 when an American reconnaissance aircraft and a Chinese fighter collided over what the Chinese said was Chinese airspace. This obviously leads to the possibility of an escalation and a crisis, which neither side really wants. Since there is no chance whatsoever that this kind of pressure will ever get Russia to return Crimea to Ukraine, it seems to me that we would be more sensible, you know, to limit ourselves to, you know, intermittent strong statements on the subject, without, you know, doing things which are likely to provoke some kind of incident like this one.
The presence of a United Kingdom warship in the Black Sea is striking enough, whether or not it was in territorial waters claimed by Russia or not. So what is the thinking at Whitehall or at the Pentagon or at the White House or at the Kremlin when the decision is made to use a warship, which after all is not skilled in diplomacy, certainly is not going to have tea with your adversary in some afternoon setting? What is the thinking? This is long-term thinking. I understand. Is it tradition, Anatole? Has there ever been an instance where it was useful, where it led to a stand down of warring forces?
Well, only if you have a tremendous preponderance of military and economic force, so that basically you can compel the other side to step down and retreat, which we don't have in this case. Or, of course, if this is part of a diplomatic effort, and you have a viable diplomatic solution in hand, which you think you can, influence the other side, in this case Russia, to agree to. But neither of these things apply. I mean, Russia, according to itself, has legally annexed the Crimea, according to the Russian constitution, confirmed by a local referendum. Short of world war, a US and NATO attack on Russia, Crimea is not going to be returned to Ukraine. So, this kind of gesture is inherently pointless. The other thing is that we proved conclusively in Georgia in 2008 and Ukraine in 2014 that we will not fight to defend these countries. We simply won't. And I think it's also pretty dangerous and irresponsible and frankly mendacious to suggest otherwise, which is what this kind of military visit does. The Ukrainians would be deeply, deeply mistaken to take this as some kind of British security guarantee or American security guarantee to Ukraine. And we just have to hope that the Ukrainians are more sensible than the Georgians in 2008 and don't actually believe this stuff.
I call upon your experience as a correspondent and reporter for several United Kingdom newspapers. I recall the London Times. I recall the Financial Times. There are probably others in your long career. You are now moving to Washington, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. So I apply myself. Does this incident bolster in some fashion a political agenda in London? Does this help Boris Johnson, given all the troubles of Brexit 5 years ago yesterday, given all the troubles of the pandemic and extending the lockdown? Is this, I'm trying to be cynical here, Anatole, because I read in the books that that's often useful. Is this a distraction from other troubles that Mr. Johnson has at home?
Well, I'm sure he thinks that it is. Johnson is an absolute master, of course, of public, spin and self-presentation. I mean, whether in fact the British public care about this is much less certain. But what it does also reflect is two other things, I think. Specifically, the British Navy is desperately anxious to show that it has a role, that the money spent on it is actually being spent for something. Because, when it comes to the defense of the United Kingdom, it's difficult to see, actually why we need a navy of this kind. So they're looking for real or imaginary roles elsewhere. So this is also about naval budgets. But more generally, it's about Brexit. The Johnson government is desperate to show that as a result of Brexit, Britain is now an independent great power on the world stage, which of course it isn't. Britain doesn't have remotely the economic or military weight to make that a reality. So they're looking for all these, symbolic things to do, invariably, of course, alongside or on the back of the United States, to go on creating this image of Britain as global Britain, Britain as a global power. The really funny and ironic thing about this is, of course, that this is pretty much exactly what many British politicians have accused Russia of doing, of suffering from, post-imperial nostalgia and this empty desire for, to be a global power. It's a real case of kettles calling pots black. So I think there's a lot of empty gesturing in this you know, in this kind of British behavior.
Anatole, I recall an incident from early in the 20th century, the British government with Winston Churchill in cabinet using the Royal Navy as a talking point. I think it went something like this. They were building dreadnoughts at the time, battleships. And Churchill's memory, it's a paraphrase, is, we could afford four. We asked for six. This is the cabinet. And Parliament gave us eight. And the illustration always meant to me that the Royal Navy is not just a military service. It's some statement of authority out of London. Do I remember that correctly?
You're absolutely right, John. But of course, the difference is that when Churchill said that, Britain was the greatest naval power on the planet. You know, we defeated the Germans in the First World War. We, you know, played a very important part in the Second World War. You know, it's not true anymore. You know, we just don't have that kind of weight. And I think also, you know, America famously has a foreign and security blob with its own particular, you know, obsessions and dogmas. And Britain, too. There's a very good book by Philip Stevens, my former colleague on the Financial Times, about this, which came out earlier this year, the way in which the obsession with great power status has, you know, shaped and warped British policy ever since the Second World War, even as, of course, British real power has got less and less.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin of the Quincy Institute. He's in the Middle East, and we're observing events in the saddle between Russia and the United Kingdom. However, at the center of this is the question about the sovereignty of Crimea, the sovereignty of Ukraine. And Anatole has written about this in recent weeks before the Geneva conversation. It's good to review that that presentation now that we've got the headlines to illustrate it. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.